Welcome back to the program. There are certain iconic symbols in America that could never be replicated today, but most importantly, represent our sense of place, our sense of shared purpose and destiny, and essentially tell us where we are. One such symbol is the Golden Gate Bridge. Built as a public works project at the depth of the Depression, it has come to symbolize both the unique nature of the Bay Area and the special connection between the urban and rural in Northern California. Now, Kevin Starr, one of our most celebrated historians, gives us an up-close and personal, rich history of the bridge and its place in the California experience. Kevin Starr is the author of the 7-volume History of California. He has served as California's state librarian. He's currently university professor and professor of history at the University of Southern California. It is my pleasure, as always, to have Kevin Starr back on this program to talk about his new volume, Golden Gate, The Life and Times of America's Greatest Bridge. Kevin Starr, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Jeff, for having me.
Pleasure to have you here. What is it about the bridge that gives us this, as you talk about it, an almost transcendent feel? I mean, certainly those of us that have driven over the George Washington Bridge, the Verrazano's Bridge many times, there is something different about the experience of seeing and being a part of the Golden Gate Bridge.
Well, I think there are many ways to say this, but I think one very quick way is to say that you're also experiencing a great work of art and architecture as you experience a great work of engineering simultaneously. And although many of these other bridges are very impressive as works of engineering and have a certain aesthetic beauty, in the Golden Gate you have, in effect, a grand sculpture, a totality of art, architecture, and engineering, making it a possessed of these sort of transcendent energies of any art form. You certainly wouldn't be baffled if you were moved by a great sculpture or a great painting, or if you listened to Beethoven's Ninth. You understand that you're in the presence of art. The fact is that the Golden Gate Bridge is doing a very practical thing. It's getting you from one side to the other, but at the same time, it's also welcoming you into the realm of aesthetic experience.
And what were the forces that came together to give this bridge that special artistic quality, that special blending of both art and engineering?
Well, I think, first of all, the site. The site's extremely dramatic. You have, at one hand, it's almost a living tableau, a tableau vivant of California history, because on the one hand, you have mankind, what man has wrought, the great city of San Francisco rising up from its site. And on the other hand, you have the wild hills, the wild headlands of Marin County, which when Sir George Simpson sailed in the 1830s, he saw it was darkened by vast herds of elk. So it's a symbol of California as nature and California as human experience. So the setting is just overwhelming, the atmospherics. And then you also have then a total complimentary statement by the bridge. You know, John Van Der Zee, in his book, earlier book on the bridge, said that that only the Parthenon is more crucially sited atop that hill in Athens. And the combination then of a great site, a great city rising up, the wild headlands of Marin, and then an artistic masterpiece of bridge engineering and design coming at an absolute breakthrough moment when this bridge was designed by a team of designers under the impresario, the executive producer, if you will, Joseph Strauss.
Talk about Joseph Strauss, because in many ways he brought together the kind of perfect storm of characters that created this
piece of art. Well, Strauss is a kind of American figure, this sort of practical visionary figure. I think we can think in terms of Henry Ford or the Wright brothers or Cyrus McCormick, Alexander Graham Bell, all these kind of slightly idiosyncratic individualists who made major breakthroughs in technology. And Strauss was, for the first part of his life as a civil engineer, a bridge builder, and Baskill bridges that rose up and down because of the employment of weights. But something happened to him when his first design for the Golden Gate Bridge, the first design that he put out in the early 1920s of two cantilevered structures with a suspension system in the middle, when that was rejected, it was called, it looked like an inverted rat trap, it was called. And he, in order to keep his job and to keep alive this transforming vision of the bridge, assembled a team. He assembled Leon Moisseiff, who had just done the Washington, George Washington Bridge, O.H. Ammon, Charles Alton Ellis, Charles Derluth, Irving Morrow. He assembled a spectacular team of engineers and one architect, and in effect, almost like a conductor, like an orchestra leader, they went to work with Strauss prodding them all, and the result was a masterpiece.
And it really was a kind of melting pot, not only of talents and personalities, but of individuals and from whence they came.
Oh, I think so. I think it's one of the beautiful side of it, and I try and emphasize that in the book, that we have old Yankees that go back to the 17th century. We have recent European Jewish immigrants. We have European Christian immigrants. We have Midwesterners. With it really is the nation through these individuals. The nation in terms of its long-term residents, in terms of the incredible influx of magnificently talented immigrants we got in the late 19th and early 20th century, all those coming together. It's almost like a Walt Whitman poem, really. I hear America singing. You could say Walt Whitman, had he been there, said, "I hear America," or "I see America designing a great bridge."
And, of course, none of it would have happened, arguably, without A.P. Giannini and Bank of America.
Well, I think, Jeff, that's a very important thing to remember, is that the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge was federally sponsored by the federal government with a reconstruction finance loan and by the state of California Division of Highways. The Golden Gate Bridge, by contrast, was done by the counties surrounding the bay, including Del Norte County on the Oregon border, and the revenue bonds, although they were guaranteed, backed up by taxpayers, were basically to be paid back through tolls, fees, and were privately funded. Strauss went into AP Giannini, the Bank of America, and Giannini bought the loans and financed the bridge.
Why were the northern counties and the work that Frank Doyle did in getting those counties to support this, why was that so important?
Well, Jeff, you have to remember that about 1909, 1910, 60% of the population of California lived in San Francisco or around the Bay Area. Therefore, if you were in the northern counties, the North Coast during that period, and you were saying, how are we going to develop our tourist industry? How are we going to develop our agriculture? How are we going to develop our cities like Sebastopol and Santa Rosa? The answer is we cannot, now that we've become an automotive culture, we cannot develop them properly if we are cut off from the population center of the state, San Francisco and the Bay Area. And so or not cut off, but dependent upon ferry travel, mm-hmm. ferry boat travel. And so that decision came really dry. Marin County and Sonoma County played a very special role in driving that bridge to conclusion.
Talk about that. What role they played?
Well, they played the role of some of the early proposals came out of Marin, and Frank Doyle then called for a meeting, and the meeting was held not in San Francisco, but in Santa Rosa. They called for a meeting of all the representatives of counties. They got together there, and they voted to form, to ask the state to form, because they didn't have the power to form it, a brand new entity, a bridge district, an entity that was not a direct expression of local government. It wasn't an agency of any county board, but it was another kind of agency coming out of the progressive movement. They took it up, the assemblyman from Napa took it to before the assembly, and it was authorized. So I think the political architecture of the bridge structure of the bridge project really came in many ways from Frank Doyle and from Marin and Sonoma counties and Napa County too, but Marin and Sonoma especially.
It also gave a strong measure of local control to this whole project that in many ways contributed to its success.
Well, absolutely, Jeff, and this is why I emphasize the bridge as an extension of city government. Now, in terms of design, I emphasize the bridge as an extension of the City Beautiful movement, which played a role in San Francisco in 1905. The Burnham Plan, which was not fully implemented after the earthquake and fire destroyed the city, But one of the early, the first two proposers of the bridge, O'Shaughnessy, was the civil and city engineer at a time when San Francisco was rebuilding itself. Now, if we look from the to the bridge from the point of view of the decade in which it was completed, we would say it's a 1930s Depression era. If we look back to the time before that, we would say it's maybe the last grand flourish, the last grand gesture, the last grand achievement of the rebuilding of San Francisco after the fire and earthquake of April 1906.
What was the engineering challenge, the unique engineering challenge that the bridge presented?
Well, just to get across that much space with only one pier, the San Francisco side pier, offshore. The Marin Pier is onshore. And so to soar across that kind of space, can you make the towers high enough? Can you make the roadbed light enough? Can you endure the winds? Can you make the bridge flexible enough in terms of its ability to absorb wind? And MOSIF gets credit, I think, in terms of the, as much as we can sort out this team, gets credit for the towers. He brought the towers up taller than any previous towers. He lightened them as they moved towards the top. He tapered them down so they could handle the winds at that point. And Charles Alton Ellis designed the suspension system and equally important, worked out the calculations that suggested or that proved or that asserted that the suspension system would work. And he worked those calculations out in an era before the computer. He worked them out by hand on a paper, a tablet and a pencil.
Talk a little bit about Strauss's impresario-like vision and what it was that he saw that this bridge could represent.
Well, I think Strauss had a deeply artistic side. When the bridge was done, he wrote a poem. Now the work is done. It's a reasonable poem. He wrote poetry in his life. Strauss had it was a romantic bridge building for Strauss right from the point, from the time he wrote his senior thesis, getting his engineering degree at University of Cincinnati. He wrote it on the possibility of a bridge between Alaska and Russia and Siberia, Russian Siberia. For Strauss, bridge building was a branch of poetry creativity. It was like writing a symphony. It was like writing a great novel. And he had that side as well as, of course, the side to orchestrate. This is very important, to orchestrate the engineering talents of others.
And like any project, even one today, there was pretty substantial opposition to this originally.
Oh, a decade long. It took really a decade of discussion and negotiation before the project was really underway. And you can see the point. It's not to criticize the War Department. They had a legitimate concern that if there was a war and the bridge were knocked down by battleships, et cetera, it would block the harbor. And the Army Air Corps had a legitimate concern that planes coming into the Bay Area would not see the bridge or would be able to become entangled in the bridge, crash into the bridge. And the shipping builders had a legitimate concern that the bridge be high enough so that the merchant fleet, the United States merchant fleet, could come in and out of it even at high tide. So the geologists, some geologists had doubts as to whether or not the geological substructure beneath the strait itself could handle the weight of that south pier. So I don't think it was old-fashioned politics. People had legitimate, and incidentally also, Jeff, some of the parts of the northern counties, especially Mendocino County, felt that they didn't want to take on the tax burden at this particular time.
Environmentalists at the time were opposed
to it
as well.
Well, the Sierra Club was opposed right from the beginning because they felt it would profane that great strait. I mean, little did they know, and they had a legitimate concern. Don't forget, they had lost, the Sierra Club had lost the Hetch Hetchy to a great dam that was being built that had been completed by 1919, the O'Shaughnessy Dam at the Hetch Hetchy. And even as they were talking about the bridge, a great aqueduct was being built from the Hetch Hetchy to San Francisco and a hydroelectrical system. So, you know, you don't make an omelet that grand as the Golden Gate without breaking some eggs. It took politics to negotiate these oppositions and to come to the consensus that was necessary for construction. In my book, I do not demonize any of these interests. They have legitimate concerns.
You talk about, in fact, at one point there was a delay on the bridge as a result of the cost overruns at Hetch Hetchy.
Well, yes. Well, O'Shaughnessy withdrew his support, and that was crucial because he had the cost overruns. So here you have one of the two original proposals of the bridge saying that it shouldn't be done. But here we were, I say we, the Bay Area, in the depth of the Depression, building two of the most monumental structures in the history of the human race, the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge and the Golden Gate Bridge. Where did we get that chutzpah? In addition, in San Francisco, to building the War Memorial Complex, the Opera House, the War Memorial Museum, in addition to really laying out construction a little later, a few years later, the Caldecott Tunnel, linking Contra Costa to the other side of the range there. I mean, all of that is really an astonishing epic of construction and finance going on at the depth of Depression.
What did the bridge represent in terms of the growing strength of car culture at the time?
Well, the Golden Gate Bridge is automotive developed. It's precipitated by the automobile because you didn't have in the North Coast a developed interurban electric culture. You had that in the East Bay. In Oakland, you had the Key system, which ran up and down the coast there, the eastern side of the bay, and it was a very successful transit system, not as extensive as the big red cars of Southern California, the Los Angeles Basin, but nevertheless impressive enough. Where North Coast was automotive driven, although Jack London went up there in 1910-11, he went up there in a wagon, a horse-drawn wagon, and wrote about this region. He called it the Switzerland of America, and that Switzerland could only be reached by train or by increasingly, or obviously horse and buggy, but increasingly also by automobiles.
One of the things you talk about is that it also was part of a kind of urban pedestrian culture.
Oh, absolutely. It's an extension of urbanism. It extends San Francisco out across that strait to Marin County, where another kind of culture, where it meets another kind of culture, an ex-urban culture. Don't forget, Marin in those days was not so much suburban entities as it was towns, San Rafael, Corte Madera, Tiburon, Sausalito, defined entities. That's what, and of course, to this day, Marin still is that, very highly developed urban constructs. And the pedestrian culture was there from the beginning. You walk out across the bridge and possess it the same way that the design of the Brooklyn Bridge almost 60 years earlier allowed for that pedestrian culture, too. You moved by foot in the city. And to this day, some 10 million people a year go walk back and forth across that bridge.
Talk a little bit about the art that has been inspired by the bridge. Not only the bridge as a piece of art and engineering, as we've talked about, but the amount of art that it has inspired.
Well, I think the best lies ahead, quite frankly. If you look at the Brooklyn Bridge, and I open up the chapter on art discussing how a whole generation in the early 1900s, Hart Crane writing the marvelous poem, The Bridge, Joseph Stella's three great paintings on the bridge, the writings on the bridge by Van Wyck Brooks and Lewis Mumford, those New Yorkers saw the Brooklyn Bridge as a symbol of New York and a symbol or an expression that urban industrial culture in America need not be ugly and repressive, but could be life-enhancing. The Golden Gate Bridge means the same things, but it's taken more time to develop it. I think the art form that has been the greatest for the bridge has been photography. The bridge photographed beautifully from the beginning. Even under construction, it photographed magnificently. Advertising has used the bridge enormously because the bridge is a recognizable icon. We have a couple novels that are very tied up with the bridge. But I think we don't have a great poem yet. We have a few paintings. I think there's a problem here in the sense that the Golden Gate Bridge is such a powerful piece of art. It speaks for itself. It'll take time, I think, for the Golden Gate Bridge to develop a body of interpretation analogous to the Brooklyn Bridge.
How was the color of the bridge arrived at?
Well, the color, the people had different ideas of the color. Some people wanted it black. The Defense Department wanted it black. The Navy wanted it striped. The Army Air Corps wanted it striped and multicolored as well. Meantime, as they discussed this, it was a primer of international orange color was put on there. Now, if you go look at the Panama Pacific Exposition of 1915, you see the color palette of that fair, including a number of colors very analogous to international orange. But take a look at those to make a continuity. This reinforces my point about looking at the bridge from the forces that developed it coming up from an earlier period, the rebuilding of San Francisco. The Panama Pacific Exposition celebrated the recovery of San Francisco from the earthquake and celebrated it in a variety of colors linked around international orange. And so that primer, as they were waiting to debate it, that primer suddenly showed its power to interact with the atmospherics of the Bay Area, the green of the hills, the trees and other vegetation, the Presidio leading in on the San Francisco side, the atmospherics of sunlight, water, fog, the color variations of the water at various times of tidal flow. And lo and behold, people like Benny Bufano, the sculptor in San Francisco, and Maynard Dixon, the artist, and Irving Morrow, who had designed who had stylized the towers, they began to say, well, why don't we just take this international orange primer and turn it into international orange lead paint and make that the color? And that was the decision. And the color, that last decision, Jeff, is part of this collaborative effort that was behind the bridge. And I don't think that without that color decision, the bridge would have reached its full potential. The color is fused into the total alembic of statement that the bridge makes.
It also is so powerful in putting forth, and Morrow, I suppose, because of the towers, the kind of Art Deco design of the moment, which it manages to capture.
It's a gorgeous design. You know, and it's inspired by theatrical architecture. The first renderings were done by the Chicago architect, Boardman, whose specialty was designing theaters. And he gave a theatrical quality to those bridges. And then Morrow was brought in, based out of the Berkeley, Oakland, San Francisco architect. And Morrow just finalized those designs. They're superb triumph of Art Deco. You have to really look to the Empire State Building or Rockefeller Center. That's to find anything comparable in terms of that Art Deco period.
And talk about what the bridge represents to the city of San Francisco today.
Well, you know, the Golden Gate was first named by John Charles Fremont, the Army explorer in the 1840s, at Chrysopolis, and he named it after the Golden Horn, the entrance to the harbor at Istanbul, earlier Constantinople in classical times. And by naming that gate there, he named it not in honor of the Gold Rush, because the Gold Rush hadn't happened yet, but in honor of the great city, like Constantinople, Istanbul, that would one day rise on the shores of this bay. And so the bridge is a powerfully urban statement. It suggests the fact that Americans had come to this California, had built these cities and this culture, and that it need not be an environmental disaster. The presence of human beings and human engineering in this landscape, it could enhance and represent a form of responsible stewardship.
And what role do you think that the bridge has played in the design of subsequent bridges around the country?
Oh, that's a fascinating question, Jeff. Because just a few years later. 3 years later, after the bridge opened, Mossiev's bridge across the Tacoma Straits collapsed in a windstorm. And I think Mossiev's bridge reached, for the time being, the limits of how light you could make a bridge to do that kind of work. That if the aerodynamics were too successful, the wind would carry the bridge away, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not an engineer, so I'm only speaking in metaphor. And I think that that after World War II, with new materials, new techniques, et cetera, bridges could continue. But very few of them if any, are lighter than this bridge. This bridge still almost, you begin to think that the greatest design for a bridge in Moshe S. mind is if the bridge would just disappear altogether and we would move on air across the Strait of the Golden Gate, because he has lightened that up. I'm sure you've had this feeling, Jeff, when you see it from offshore or see it at a distance, how light it is.
Mm-hmm.
In comparison to all the other bridges. Now, there's a similar feeling, I think, with the Coronado Bridge down in San Diego. But the Golden Gate Bridge, all these years later, still holds its own as a
Even the Verrazano's, which is a bit longer, doesn't have the same feel.
It doesn't have that I use the word aerodynamic. You could use any word you want. There's a sense here where art has taken over engineering, or art and engineering are reconciled to each other in a beautiful way.
Kevin Starr, his book is Golden Gate: The Life and Times of America's Greatest Bridge. It's just out from Bloomsbury. Kevin, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you, Jeff, and enjoy the bridge.
Thank you.